It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. This morning, President Obama delivered a speech in Havana carried live by Cuban state television, giving Mr. Obama a historic opportunity to speak directly to the Cuban people. The speech caps the president's visit to Cuba, the first by a U.S. president in nearly 90 years. There is, of course, the matter of the baseball game that he will be going to today between the Tampa Bay Rays and the beloved Cuban national team. So the question becomes, what will it mean for average Cubans, average Americans, and folks right here in Pittsburgh, this visit by the president, this renewal of relations between the United States and Cuba? Joining us in studio to discuss the future of U.S. and Cuban relations is Kenya Dworkin Emendez, who is Carnegie Mellon University Associate Professor of Hispanic Studies, and also Scott Morgenstern, who is Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Pittsburgh. Thanks to both of you for being here.
Thanks for the invitation.
Thanks for having us.
And you can join the conversation by calling 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. Email is essspgh@wesa.fm and on Twitter at essspgh. Kenya Dworkin Emendez and Scott Morgenstern, what is your take, first of all, on what you've been hearing President Obama say from Cuba yesterday, today with the big speech? How do you assess it?
Go ahead.
Oh, I'm very, very much impressed with what President Obama has been saying in Cuba. I think he came out quite openly, but very diplomatically, addressing issues of the freedom of exchange ideas. I think he came out very openly with the idea that Cubans need access to information through the internet, and that the exchange of ideas, that the Cuban government should not be afraid of their own people's ideas.
Which they traditionally have been and still continue to be.
Correct.
And that is sort of the elephant in the room and the thing that has been, in spite of all the smiles and the handshakes and all of that, there's this undercurrent of tension, and that's the source of it. Scott Morgenstern, let's get your overall impressions of just what's been happening down in Cuba. You can't ignore the history of this. It certainly made us somewhat euphoric, but is that euphoria tempered by the political tensions I referred to?
There's clearly tensions that you're seeing. You're seeing the violence that's come on TV that they've repeated over and over again of the ladies in white that have been arrested and other protests that have been trying to make their voice heard at the time while Obama is there, which I guess, you know, I think is an important part of what's going to happen there, perhaps with the changes that may occur, is that these kind of things are publicized to the world. And so this will be important for the human rights. And as Kenya said, Obama's had a number of different audiences as he's talked to them here, talking, as she and I were talking before the show, to the people of Cuba, to the Cuban-American crowd, to the government of Cuba, and very directly. She used the word diplomatically. I think you could also say pretty forcefully in speaking out about some very direct issues about the human rights issues and the possibilities and the directions for future. Also being very friendly. He said, "Very, you know, I'm extending a hand of friendship to the Cubans, and we have our differences." But he's also saying we respect those differences, but that doesn't mean that we shouldn't be open to exploring them and pushing for important changes.
Right. I mean, we have differences of opinions with all sorts of countries around the world that we have diplomatic relations with, and it would be, I think, odd if at some point, and it's taken a long time, if a president didn't make some sort of overture, as the Obama administration is doing and has done, to a country that's, what, 90 miles from Miami Beach?
From Key West.
So
he made a very strong case for disagreement within democratic systems. And when he anticipated being challenged on the issue of democracy in the United States and the problems we have here. And he made a very strong case of the fact that it allows us to debate, to disagree. And these are the things that are not openly possible in Cuba.
Right. And certainly open dissent is a problem. Things that we can do here in the United States, some of the things that we're seeing at political rallies would be impossible to have in Cuba, which still has the one party system of politics of the Communist Party. We'll get into some of that and also some of these independent civil society organizations in Cuba beyond the Ladies in White, which is the one that we hear about. It's kind of a regular Sunday event there where these women go out, they protest, they get arrested, they're in jail for a couple of hours, and then they're released. But there's more going on below the surface that I know you want to address, Kenya. But we also want to get to some comments that the president has made in Cuba. And we're going to start with his comments on trade issues. This is from yesterday.
It's a historic opportunity to engage directly with the Cuban people and to forge new agreements and commercial deals, to build new ties between our two peoples, and for me to lay out my vision for a future that's brighter than our past.
And that was actually from Sunday, when he just after he landed. I recognized the baby crying in the background. Scott Morgenstern, you know, certainly an emphasis here has been on allowing U.S. companies to work with businesses associated with the Cuban government. Is this the best way to change Cuba by exposing Cubans to American goods?
Well, that's certainly the argument that Obama is making, and I think it makes a lot of sense, although it's not just goods, of course. He's also talking about communication and internet and being able to have open debates and learn what's going on.
And that's, some of that's been relaxed, hasn't it, in Cuba?
The internet, the quality of the internet. First of all, only 5% of the people in Cuba have access to internet regularly. The internet penetration is very poor. It's the lowest in this hemisphere. And those are people who may have access to it through work, for example. There is no such thing as a cable company or an internet company that Cuban citizens can subscribe to get internet service. And the internet that does exist, the broadband, is extremely inferior. And it's censored.
Hmm. But there are places that you can go now and get it. There's actually hotspots in parks and things. But
for
again,
Wi-Fi, correct.
But very few people, you know, a very limited number of people still have access.
And there's very little you can do, given the amount of time that you may be able to be at that spot to, let's say, download documents or upload documents and things like that.
Okay, so that having been said, what new agreements and commercial deals are being forged, Scott?
Well, one thing that's important to remember is during the embargo, at least since 2000, there has been a lot of trade in agricultural products that the farmers here have been
were
very successful in pushing that. And we send several hundred millions of dollars a year of agricultural products to Cuba, which is often forgotten.
And how much of that is from Pennsylvania?
I don't know the statistic.
I don't know the exact statistic, but we have had agricultural relations with them for at least 10 or 15 years now.
Yeah. A huge percentage of it is chickens, poultry. And the other parts of it are soybean meal or the other big products. But I'd have to look that up.
So there are loopholes in or ways to get around the embargo.
But what's changing now with the new agreement is that they've reduced the restrictions on the kind of banking requirements that we have. And also a very important change is that until very recently, U.S. companies could only work with directly with individuals in Cuba who are not associated with the government. Since everybody and every business was associated with the government, that was a tremendous restriction. That has been relaxed so that now now businesses in the U.S. can work with companies that are related to the government. That'll be a huge change. The other really important change, and this has been over the last little while, is that Cuba opened a free trade zone. They opened a big port, the Mariel port, which is a high-tech port, and it's going to be a transshipment place for many of the very large tanker or container ships that are going to go through the widened Panama Canal. And around the port is a free trade zone. And the first U.S. business then has started constructing, fabricating tractors, and they've gotten permission. And other businesses are getting more permissions to go and work there.
And there was also the president's comments on bridging cultural differences. Let's listen to what President Obama had to say about that.
I think that if you meet Cubans here and Cubans meet Americans and they're meeting and talking and interacting and doing business together and going to school together and learning from each other, then they'll recognize people are people. And in that context, I believe that change will occur.
So what are the cultural differences to be bridged? Because there's a very different, and I've not experienced any of this firsthand, but people that I know who have gone to Cuba said, you know, the pace of life, the philosophy, just the general approach to life down there is very different from the way we approach it here. So can you speak to that?
I think that's true, but I don't think that's an insurmountable difference. The fact is that actually for the last 150 or 200 years, there's been a very close relationship between Cuba and the United States, except in the last 50-something years, and that actually at the level of people or society, there's always been a great deal of knowledge about the United States on the part of the Cuban people. Cuba was a country that received ideas and products from the United States prior to any other country in Latin America because of the proximity. Many in the Cuban elite sent their children to be educated in the United States. So there's always been a lot of knowledge. Culturally, we're going to be different because, first of all, we come from very different colonial experiences. Secondly, they have a very much more racially diverse society than we do. They have a much, much higher Afro-descendant population than we do, and it's much more visible in their culture than it is in our culture.
Does that make it more of a challenge for us to gain? I mean, obviously the Cubans appreciate the political freedoms that we have here and would like to see us influence their government perhaps in that way. But at the same time, are they less willing to open themselves up, to trust us and fully engage in a real, genuine friendship when they hear, I'm sure the government lets them know that, do you realize the kind of disparity that exists in pay for men and women in the United States? Do you realize the lack of diversity in terms of some of the opportunities for people in the United States? You're much better off here.
That's the rhetoric the government has used all along to demonize the United States and capitalism and democracy.
So I guess what I'm asking is, do we need to clean up our act a little bit? Is that part of what needs to happen here to open up this relationship?
Well, I, quite independently of the issue of Cuba, I do think we need to clean up our act. But I don't think it's so much a question of cleaning up our act, but rather not preaching to them, but rather leading by example. And as the president said today, we have issues with racism. We have issues. In fact, he mentioned the fact that he was a biracial child brought up by a single mother, who in this country was still able to become the president of the United States. That has not been possible in Cuba, not during this regime or ever in Cuban history. So I think it's a question of not preaching to them, not telling them what they need to do so that we'll play with them, so to speak, but rather looking for points where we can work together, whether it's through business, whether it's through medical research, whether it's through baseball, which I think is a great line for diplomacy, given the history of baseball in both countries. I mean, there are ways for us to find places to meet, and as far as what the government is telling the Cubans or has been telling the Cubans and what Cubans know, they've always had, the Cuban people have always had a love affair with the U.S. people. So it's the issues have been between governments, but not between the people.
But I think to go back to your original question, which was how do the differences affect this relationship, there are some reasonable fears. And you know, you said it's the Cubans harping or worrying about this, but I think there are some real fears, and they see our income distribution problems,
sure,
our racial problems, our, you know, our rat race of what is capitalism. And when you're in Cuba, you know, it is a much more relaxed pace, and you know, they don't have a lot, but it's a pretty happy people, a lot of music and you know, and things going on. And I don't want to, you know, overstate that by any means, because there's just desperate needs and wants there as well. But it is a clash of cultures when you're getting together. And there's a serious worry of when you open these floodgates to the American markets and to the American businesses, of what that will mean in the change of the way that they live their lives. A lot of great benefits, absolutely, but also some important challenges.
Absolutely.
Scott, what opportunities, and Kenya as well, what opportunities does this opening up of Cuba create for Pittsburgh and Pennsylvania? You've mentioned some of the economic, some of the trade opportunities that have already been created for the state of Pennsylvania. What else can we do as we watch Cuba begin to open up more?
Well, for one, there's more exchanges in terms of tourism and traveling. I mean, Pitt has had University of Pittsburgh has had a study abroad program with Cuba for years. This year we have 15 people signed up to go, and they're going to be there for about 6 weeks this summer. In the past, you know, there were a lot more restrictions on what they could do. Now it's going to be that much more open, and they can travel and they can interview people and they can be involved in all kinds of projects. I mean, they're working with students and taking classes with, you know, with Cuban professors and all kinds of different things. So there's a lot of opportunities from that point of view. Individuals, one of the important changes that was just announced is that they're further reducing the restrictions on person-to-person travel. So instead of having to go on the formal, pretty expensive trips that you can go on, well, now you can go and, if I understand correctly, you can just keep a log of the educational things that you're doing, which includes going to the museum and talking to people. You don't have to be on formal educational exchanges. So that's just one more of the ways that it'll be important for people.
So if you happen to meet someone down there that you like, that you form a bond with, you can go down there to visit them, and that was not possible before.
It was very difficult.
Yeah, right.
But it was very difficult. I think there are a lot of opportunities for Pittsburgh. For example, it would be great to see something like what's been going on with Miami-Dade College with regard to offering college-level courses so that Cuban students can come up and study here. That would be a great thing, to have faculty come, to have faculty exchange. But Pittsburgh has a long history of a relationship with Cuba. And I think that one of the greatest things that we can, and as a matter of fact, I should say that Carnegie even had a nickel mine in Cuba, I discovered, which I thought was interesting. So our history to Cuba goes way back. But there have been organizations here locally that have been in existence for quite a while that have worked on people-to-people exchange, the Sister Cities Project, different kinds of academic and social projects. I think that Pittsburgh, being a city that has recently embraced forms of civil dialogue through things like the selection of the police chief that was done through deliberative conversations and so on. I think the fact that Pittsburgh has rates highly in the civil index as a city in this country, I think we have many kinds of behaviors that as a society with independent cultural and community organizations, I think they could learn a lot from us, and we could learn a lot from the way their organizations work, especially the independent ones.
It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer, and my guests are Kenya Dworkin-Emendez, who is a Carnegie Mellon University Associate Professor of Hispanic Studies, and Scott Morgenstern, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Pittsburgh. We're talking about the president's visit, President Obama's visit to Cuba, an historic one, first time a U.S. president has gone to Cuba in an official capacity in nearly 90 years. We're wondering about what kinds of opportunities that opens up for the American people in general, people in Pittsburgh and Pennsylvania in particular. And we'd like to hear from you. You can join the conversation with your comments or questions about this historic occasion. 412-246-2002 is the number to call. Again, 412-246-2002. Email esspgh@wesa.fm and on Twitter at ESSPGH. We'll take a break and come right back. It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. And in the wake of President Obama's historic visit to Cuba, we are talking about what it means for average Cubans, average Americans, and folks right here in Pittsburgh with Kenya Dworkin-Emendez, Carnegie Mellon University Associate Professor of Hispanic Studies, and Scott Morgenstern. He's Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Cuba. You can join the conversation at 412.
University of Pittsburgh.
What did I say?
University of Cuba.
University of Cuba.
Oh, well.
See, I've got Cuba on the brain.
Slip of the tongue.
You know, the Cubans could end up offering you a job. Scott's with the University of Pittsburgh, folks, just to clarify that. And if there were such a job, would you be interested in it? You probably would be.
It's a pretty interesting place to be down there.
We're hearing about that more and more. 412-246-2002 to join the conversation. 412-246-2002. Email esspgh@wesa.fm. On Twitter, at esspgh. I wanted to play one more excerpt of some of the comments that President Obama has been making in Cuba. This is concerning the political differences that exist between the United States and Cuba. How do Obama and Raul Castro work through their differences? Let's listen first to what the president had to say.
We continue, as President Castro indicated, to have some very serious differences, including on democracy and human rights. And President Castro and I have had very frank and candid conversations on these subjects. We have a half a century of work to catch up on.
Half a century. There's a lot to catch up on there. And we talked earlier, Kenya, about the women in white, and you said that when it comes to independent civil society organizations in Cuba, that it goes well beyond that particular group that is very visible. What can you tell us about what's happening perhaps below the surface a little bit?
Yes, the ladies in white are the ones who get attention because they do march every Sunday and are repressed. And now more and more people are joining them, and also representatives of other organizations. What people need to understand is that that civil society in Cuba is defined by the government. In other words, to have a civil society organization, of which there are thousands, they must be, if not created by, governed by the government. So there are no independent societies, or they haven't been for a long time. As of about 10 or 12 years now, there are a number, and the number keeps growing, of independent civil society groups who essentially exist illegally in Cuba, and they're not the ones going out marching necessarily, although the Ladies in White is one. These are true non-governmental organizations because they're they are non-governmental and they're not defined by the government. And there are a number of groups that are working who are political scientists, who are historians, who are people interested in human rights, who are working towards finding solutions to moving Cuba forward, but not with a total regime change, but rather helping Cuba transition to a social democracy. And they address issues, for example, in the Constitution. People in the United States, and if you say what people need to do here, they need to learn more about the realities of Cuba, the lack of freedom of assembly, the lack of freedom of association, the lack of freedom of expression, the gag laws, which are all in the Constitution.
Right. There are human rights abuses that
are
happening.
But they're codified in the Constitution.
Well. But there's also that. There's also the denial of Raul Castro, who says when President Obama was trying to highlight the issue of human rights abuses, Castro denied that his country has any political prisoners.
Correct. And he said, show me the list and I'll release them. And within 5 minutes, some activists had the list ready for him, but I'm sure he won't look at it. There are 51 people who are political prisoners right now in Cuba. And that is the purpose for which the Ladies in White primarily march. These organizations focus on different issues, some of them on constitutional reform, some on gay rights, some on political prisoners, there's a group called Connect Cuba, which focuses on the issue of internet and the lack of internet access. So people need to learn what's going on the ground there, because change is going to come, as the president said, must come from the ground up.
We have lots of folks on the line with questions. We'll get to all of you at 412-246-2002. Let's start with Musa in McKeesport. I hope I'm pronouncing your name correctly. Welcome.
Thank you for having me. I'd just like to ask if you could speak to the subject. I've heard through the years, I've heard so many good comments on the medical help that Cuba has supplied to the African countries and to the various South American countries. Could you speak to that, please, for me?
Yeah.
Sure, we can say a few words about it. Cuba has been, there's been a number of different things. I mean, one thing that Cuba got a world recognition for, including John Kerry talking about it, is when Cubans went and helped with the Ebola crisis, for example. And one of the advantages of the opening is that we can work with Cuba on a more direct basis on these kind of world health issues. The Zika virus is another one that Cuba has been at the forefront in working with. The issue of Cuban doctors is very complicated, though. For a while, they continue to more or less trade their doctors to other countries as an export. So they send doctors on relatively short or up to a couple of year terms where they work, lots of them in Latin America, but also in some parts of Africa, Brazil and Venezuela, primarily in Latin America. And in exchange, those countries would then trade, for Venezuela, it was oil, for example, while the doctors that were being sent they were still working for the Cubans, so they were earning very little money. But it was a big benefit because they were sent to very rural and difficult places. So there was a lot of pretty interesting policies that were going on in terms of the medical field there.
And the other thing is, too, that there's a lot of medical research going on in Cuba that because our markets don't work together, we have no access to. So they have produced a number of products, for example, a totally green rodenticide, an organic rodenticide. They have vaccines that they have worked on in the AIDS area, in the area of meningitis. They have anti-tumor medication that has fewer side effects than the stuff that we're using here that's cutting edge. So there's a lot to be gained to have access to each other's research and products.
Thank you for that question, Don. Let's go to Mike in Pittsburgh. Hi, Mike. You're on the air with Kenya Dworkin-Mendez and Scott Morgenstern.
Hello.
Hello, Mike. You're on the air.
Yeah, I just want to know, how is this helping Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and jobs? That's what we need here is jobs.
All right. Well, go ahead, Scott.
The truth is, I think it has pretty limited impact. Not zero, but I think it's limited. Cuba is a poor country with 11 million people. So there's a relatively limited market there, even if it were, if trade were free. So I don't think that we can expect a transformational change of what's going to happen with any kind of openness. So the influence of this openness or new relations with Cuba, a lot of it's symbolic. A lot of it is ending the Cold War. There are, some companies that will take advantage, some farmers that will be able to send more products, perhaps some telecommunications, et cetera. But we have to recognize that it's a poor country with 11 million people. It's not it's not China.
And we have another question. I jumped ahead. We had Musa on earlier, so I wanted to thank Musa for his question, as well as Mike, whom you just heard. Now we go to Don, who has a question that is definitely ties in with this conversation. Hi, Don. How are you?
I'm doing fine. My question is can one of your professors speak on the disparities of economic, social, and opportunities based upon the color of skin in Cuba?
Yes, there is.
Wait, hang on a second.
I'm sorry.
Go ahead, Don. You had more there?
Yes, I'm here. I'm just saying that's pretty much why I had my question right there.
Okay.
Okay. Yeah. You're absolutely right. Some of the disparities that the revolution attempted to address early on after its triumph were assuaged.
You're talking about Fidel in 1959.
Correct, and right after that, I mean, many of the first of all, Cuba tried to do away with racism by virtually declaring it illegal.
What was
we
it
know
like?
That
what was
work.
It like under Batista?
Well, under Batista or anybody else, first of all, you have a very high number of Afro descendants living in Cuba, who have always historically been at the bottom of the socioeconomic ladder during all regimes. Ever since Cuba, before it was even independent or after it was independent. But
so when the revolution happened, Fidel Castro was going to address it.
Yes, and some of this happened through the open access to education. And so things were mitigated for quite a while, and Afro-Cubans made a great deal of progress for the first 20 or so years, or maybe even 30 years. After 1989, when the Soviet bloc collapsed and the economy essentially collapsed, in Cuba, then all of a sudden, a lot of the disparities began to return because since it was sort of dog-eat-dog at that point, then a lot of hiring practice went back to older hiring practices where black people would be disadvantaged. Black people tend to live in the worst neighborhoods. I mean, this has always been the case. And part of the fact that we can't talk about race in Cuba, or only the government can talk about race, means that we can't have conversations about race and the effects of discrimination and institutionalized racism the way we do in the United States. In Cuba, this is not possible. The government has to guide those conversations. So there are many independent groups, like the ones I was talking about before, who focus specifically on this issue of the disenfranchisement of blacks. They've never been representative in government in 55 years of Cuban government right now. And they are not leaders in industry or in any area. And so therefore, the last almost 30 years have sort of brought them back down to a level approximating where they were before the revolution. But they do have education. They're highly skilled, And so it's an issue. It's a human rights issue in Cuba that racism be addressed and discrimination be addressed. But the rhetoric of we're all Cubans above our skin color keeps that conversation under the table and in the control of the government.
Okay, I'm going to try to get in as many more questions as we can in the limited time we have remaining. But we keep hearing about normalization of relations, you know, between the United States and Cuba. What, Scott, does normal look like, and when will we see it?
That's a difficult question to answer. I think there's a lot of different things that are going on. I mean, normalization formally was simply opening the embassies to have, you know, that we're allowed to have talks between our governments. But there are a lot of different pieces of that we have special laws and regulations with Cuba that we don't have with any other country in the world.
And for some people, it's just getting their hands on some Cuban cigars or Cuban rum.
Well, that would be the simple part. But, you know, I think right. there's a lot of other much more important issues.
Certainly.
You know? I mean, I think migration or immigration is probably
right. Let's talk about that.
At the focus. You know, as you know, there's the wet foot, dry foot policy that continues to reign for Cubans. So that means that if a Cuban gets to the shores in the United States, they get to walk in and get legal status. Not true for any other country in the world. Many of the Cubans now, with the normalization process, fear that that's going to end, and so there's been even a larger wave of Cubans trying to get here from any different mode possible.
Why was the door open? Was it just, we're going to save you from communism, come join us?
Exactly, and that's the policy that many of Ted Cruz continues to advocate for, and many of the Republicans, that this was, you're fleeing from communism, and the evils of the communism means that the United States should open their doors, and the idea was that it put more pressure on the Cuban government.
Okay, 20 seconds or less. Should Americans for their enthusiasm for traveling to Cuba and engaging with Cubans while abuses continue to happen? You're saying no.
No, I don't think they should temper. I just think they should be informed. I think they should be fully informed of what kind of country they're visiting, and understand that when they're connecting with people there, there's a lot of depth to that society and a lot of things going on in that society that we know nothing about, because all we ever get is the official word. So I think they should go.
Well, there are certainly many issues, that most of which we've been able to cover here to some extent, to a greater or lesser extent. It's a multi-layered situation, and one that we'll be curious about watching unfold between the United States and Cuba. We've been talking with Kenya Duarkany Mendez, Carnegie Mellon University Associate Professor of Hispanic Studies, and Scott Morgenstern, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Pittsburgh. Thank you both for being here. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. So long for now.